pattern of controlling and grabbing all of the resources, centralization, hyper-centralization and control, right?
I think that I'm tracing that back to the populist movement in the 1890s.
Why?
It has to do with money creation.
Okay.
I'm working on a book about my grandfather, of all things.
Oh,
he was a
populist.
So there was a lot written then that we never hear about, and one of our members is talking about how this education has been deliberately removed from the school systems. So part of it traces back to the invention of grains as a storable commodity. So it goes back to the grain merchants wanting to concentrate and develop these big areas. So
I mean, you could look at like sea sales, for instance. There is a bunch of small independent companies doing sea sales. Selling seeds, and almost all of them went bankrupt.
Because the corporations,
the corporations
say, no, sorry, you know, you can't, and then they have their little detectives running around the fields and
it
say,
gets really icky.
You've got a fine, we're going to take you to court.
It gets
because,
really ugly.
Because it came in the wind or in the...
Right, what, exactly.
Right.
Yeah, how do they get away with that?
You know, they get away with it because we allow them to. And in the moment that we say we're not, the moment that we learn to say no is the moment that we start changing it. I mean, but it's hard. It's not easy.
It is hard because it happened in the revolution and then it happened again with the populace. Supposedly there was a landslide victory for McKinley against Bryan, and it wasn't a landslide. You know, it was media perpetrated, but anyway.
Oh, there's so much history, isn't there?
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to start on time, and then, but I kind of let it, because I'm sure more people are going to be late tonight, so.
Reward us.
Reward us, yeah, we're going to start on time, so. Let's see. Let me just take a moment to get myself, make sure I'm doing it right.
I'm going to attempt to live stream. I don't know how to be able to get a picture or not, but I'm going to try to live stream.
So, great. So, modern industrial farming amounts to one of the most destructive enterprises on the planet. Modern industrial farming is one of the most destructive enterprises on the planet. We are participating in a great zombie food experience. Right now, we are experiencing a zombie food. 99% of our food, 99% of our food comes from the industrial system. And as about in 2012, half of all U.S. adults now have some type of chronic disease.
Mm-hmm.
Half of us. Large percent of us have more than two. The most prescribed drugs for our teenagers is for anxiety and depression. And I don't watch TV, you know, once it's switched to digital, I don't even have TV, but somehow they turned onto this Walking Dead. I watched a little bit of it. And if you look at our culture, it does seem like there's all these skeletons and people are talking about zombies. And I think that represents something about how we're living, that's kind of emerging from ourselves, because there's a truth there. The UN reports that there are 146 dead zones. More than 40% of Minnesota waters are listed as impaired or polluted. Now, here's an example. Chlorophyophis. How many here have ever heard of chlorophyophis? Okay. So the president, I have a letter, the president of the American Academy of Pediatrics, 66,000 pediatric doctors, signed this letter with the president of the Environmental Working Group in a couple weeks ago. And he wrote to the EPA and he said, chlorophyophis causes, I'm quoting, brain damage to developing fetuses, infants, children, and pregnant women. Chlorophyophis causes brain damage to developing fetuses, infants, children, and pregnant women. It is authorized for use on nearly 50 food crops, including fruits and vegetables. And the Department of Agriculture found chlorophyophis on commonly eaten fruits, including peaches and nectarines. The EPA's own calculations suggest that babies, children, and pregnant women are now eating more chlorophyophis than is safe.
Would you write the name of that compound on the board, please?
Sure. And I do have, what I will do, and when I do that, I'm going to also pass around the letter. So you guys can do some details on this, and also so I can check the spelling.
Sounds like a real challenge to spell.
Yeah. Somebody Google it. And yes, Google is a verb.
You got to know how to spell it before you can Google it.
Maybe I'll choose a different one.
Me.
Yeah.
This is good. This is good.
Okay, this actually made it a different
yeah, I know.
So,
like, aren't they all?
Other.
Yeah, they are.
We're here for Norm.
Oh, our ears.
Okay.
I attended one yesterday with
So chlorophyllosis causes brain damage according to the Academy of Pediatrics. And the Dow Chemical's response to it, this is their response to April 21st, here's their quote. Chlorophyllosis is in fact one of the most widely used and thoroughly studied pest control products in the world. Do not buy anything from Dow Chemical. I don't buy anything from Dow Chemical. I mean, but anyhow, that gets me angry, right? But I think it's an example of a zombie culture. We see it all over the place. I mean, how, you know, it's the American Academy of Pediatrics. How are we, that's just a non-living culture. And I think that the exit gate from the zombie world is girlcotting, not boycotting. Again, 99% of our food is the industrial system. We need to figure out how to girlcot the system. And that's what the primary of this is going to be, is how do we change this system? I love Principle 6 from the Co-op Trade Movement. Anyone familiar with it? Okay, so Principle 6 of the Co-op Trade Movement is guided by shared values and three overarching criteria. Cooperative, small, local. P6 is owned by and designed for grocery co-ops and cooperative food producers. P6 is the symbol of a growing consumer-supported food economy, recognizing products grown and produced locally or internationally by small farmers and producers and cooperatives. And I love this quote from E.O. Wilson. So E.O. Wilson says, cheaters may win within the colony, variously requiring a larger share of resources, but colonies of cheaters lose to colonies of cooperators. And he also said that we can create the beginnings of a paradise on earth if we do three things. One, use the unrelenting application of reason. Two, a basic sense of kindness and an understanding of who we are. So I think with that understanding of who we are, again, so the basic format is I want to spend time just looking at all the negatives of the food system. I want to take a 2-minute break and just be quiet, and then talk about the solutions and how we decentralize. But then we can just kind of go around and say who's in the room, can kind of grave. So my name's Laura Hedlund. I do a food show called Food Freedom Radio. I've been working at AM 950, which is owned by a person who only owns one radio station. We've stayed in business. Al Franken was our first talk show host. Bernie Sanders was on our air for 11 years on Tom Hartman's show. We carry Democracy Now! We also have a really cool, some other programs you can pick up anywhere, like Hidden Edges Radio with Ellie Krug. She's a transgender lawyer. We have Native Roots Radio with Robert Pilot. So, you know, check us out there.
What's the number again?
AM 950. And if you need to, because you can put a zip code in, like 55414, we're working on that. Right now, it might ask for a Minnesota zip code. Just put in a Minnesota zip code. But So introducing myself, I'm a truck driver's daughter. You know, I'm a truck driver's daughter, and I grew up with two vacations every year, six kids in the family, and my mom didn't work. You know, I mean, there was just something that was going on at that time, and I'm very grateful. And the reason that we were able to live that life is because in Minneapolis, there was a truck driver strike in 1935. You know, it's all connected. And I feel like I'm really sad about what's happening environmentally and to people. And, you know, I'm just sad. I think we all are. And I know that somehow we need to change things. So I have done a community garden for 7 years. I practice something called permaculture. Anyone know permaculture?
Yes.
Yeah, so I've done permaculture. I did an 8-month permaculture course, and I have a peach from the yard I picked this morning and some tomatoes from my yard I picked this morning. So
they're good.
So if we want to just go around and quickly say name, favorite food, or any organization, or anything else you'd like to say.
Favorite food.
Anything you want to say about food, but try to be quick, you know, because... So I guess we can start here.
I'm Cindy K. Sosby. I'm from Houston, and I'm with different organizations. I came here with politics and stuff, Facebook, citizen journalism, but I'm very interested in learning about permaculture and sustainable living and eating good food.
And one of our weekly talk show hosts, Mike McEntee, is a leader in citizen journalism. He does something called The Uptake, and he has a show. So.
I'm Carol Turpin-Hearn. My father was a farmer, 230 acres more or less. from the knob region of Kentucky, which means we did not have flat fields. So, you know, it's a different mindset there. And I am a biology major, chemistry minor, secondary ed, but I have worked for environmental protection with the state. I've worked for a railroad. I mean, I've kind of bounced around. But if you haven't checked out Kentucky Proud, check it out. It's local food farmers selling their crops in our communities.
Great.
Joy Arnold, Central Kentucky, out of the Knobs, not to the mountains, in the flatlands. And my most recent interest has come to be with indigenous plants and trying to nourish and protect them.
Hiroshi Kano. We have a small farm north of Madison, 70 acres. I'm really retired from the federal government, so I'm really not a farmer. But I'm part of the Family Farm Defenders, which we joined after coming up here. So.
Geraldine Perry, southwest suburbs of Chicago. I've been involved in this a long time, probably because of my cousin, who was friends with Charles Walters for 25 years before he died. And I wrote two books, one with him and another one that tries to link climate change to land use and monetary policy. The biggest focus is on agriculture, because that's where the solution lies. And I have made a website that has a lot of information, health information on it. But through that website, I found a food group, local farmers that meet. It's an hour away from me, but they meet once a month, and we get our we have local farmers there that come to the meeting, and local horticulturalists that will bring their products from the men. But we, our whole goal with that group is to support local farming the real way, where you rebuild the land. And the other part, I also belong to a co-op that I get most of my food from because it's closer, but they get from locally produced food. Some of it is Amish and other is not. So that's been a focus of my life for 20 years or more.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Laura Van Rensselaer from Gunnison, Colorado. It's a 6,000 people town, 8,000 feet up in the mountains, and we're so isolated, we're 65 miles from the nearest town. And that's over two big mountain passes. So we're very interested in sustaining ourselves, and but we have a growing season that's very short because nights, even in the summer, get down to in their low 30s. And it's kind of hard to grow food there, but we do have two farmers market sessions, and there's many of us are interested in living sustainably and where we're going to get our food and water.
Mm-hmm. Where did you say you live?
Gunnison.
Colorado.
Oh, okay.
Hi, I'm Sue Peters. I'm from New York City.
A little contrast there.
Yeah. but I'm blessed because I'm through the years I got connected with a food group. So every 2 weeks, our Amish farmer from his big, huge organic farm with his 10 kids brings in all this food, which is great. Oh my God, this isn't great. So I'm blessed with that, and also I'm blessed half a block from me, which used to be this tiny little store run by Indians, is now this huge health food store. So I mean, they don't source from local, but at least that's there. So I'm blessed with that. But I'm here because I'm a member of two organizations. One is one of the sponsors of the convention, the American Monetary Institute. Mm. So how our money system has affected corporate farming is really, really important to know. But also I'm a member of NORM, the National Organization of Raw Materials, which is farmers, family farmers. And they have taught me how the economy works, because they know that farming and agriculture is the basis of our entire economy, and that was a new thought for me, new thought. And I have some flyers for Norm if you want to, you know, read more. But they have proof about all of this. They developed from the 1930s, and they actually anyway. So thank you.
Thank you.
My name is John Howell. I'm from Athens, Ohio, and we have a local organization, Democracy Over Corporation, that's affiliated both with Move to Amend and with the American Monetary Institute. And we have active people in the group who are farmers and who often carry the message, if we only fixed up the soil so there'd be enough nutrients in the soil, so then we wouldn't need all these drugs that the medical profession is pushing on us. And so I'm interested in that particular portion of our Democracy Over Corporations has not really emerged with sort of a central kind of project, or and so I'm looking for connections and so on, and how to pass that on to folks back home that might be able to might be useful for them in terms of doing something in that area.
I'm Jerry Davidson from Ripon, Wisconsin, and I'm interested in sustainable farming and organic vegetarianism.
I'm Rick Lass. I live in southwestern New Mexico. I have a very small farm compared to what I've been hearing over on the other side of the room. It's about an acre, and we've only got half of it under cultivation right now. But I also work one day a week at an organic food, it's not a co-op, but it's a nice health food store. And the thing that's most interesting to me I've been encountering is how many Americans just want cheap food, and they don't care about the quality of it, they don't care about how it's produced. I've done some research on it too, and we pay, you know, percentage of income that Americans pay for food is so small compared to other countries that expect to pay more but get more quality.
What's the elevation of that farm?
6,200 feet.
I figured you were pretty high up.
Yeah, we're up in the
National
Forest.
Yeah, well, so, my name is Lynn. I live in New Orleans, from New York. I am a gardener, but I run composting programs in places where the city usually doesn't have any sort of municipal infrastructure. I partner with local libraries, and people drop off their food waste, and then I partner with different urban farms and community gardens for them to then take the food waste away and turn it into compost. I did that in New York City, collected about 150,000 pounds a year at four branches, you know, an hour and a half a week, and just started some local program in New Orleans, and so we collect a couple of thousand pounds a month. So the zombie soils part of your title was something I'm very interested in. And then being from New Orleans, we had massive flooding last night. Part of the issue with the drainage in the city, especially post-Katrina, our soils very compacted, very clay heavy. So I know a lot of focus has been on soil for growing healthy food, but there's other reasons to improve soils.
I just need to pop in a little bit on that. Cheap food is not cheap is something I say every week. But the other thing is, it's also an accessibility issue. I mean, and I, you know, sometimes we want to blame the victim, and you know, because it's a system. And as much as you can look at systems instead of people choose.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. If Americans had better paying jobs, we wouldn't have to eat the cheap food.
Exactly.
It goes right back to the economic system and the monetary system.
100%.
Well, just your car insurance work,
yeah,
that's a big chunk of your income, yeah,
right,
and yeah, your rent, yeah,
yeah. It's stupid.
Well, I'm Pat Christensen. I live in Minneapolis, and I spent 30 years promoting bicycling and working for a company that promoted bicycling, having repair shops supported so that you could have a cheap or expensive bike that was always in good working condition, and a lot of lobbying for bike paths and bike trails and ways to get outdoors safely, and helmets, a lot on helmets. I'm also thinking about your comment, and part of what I think is that people are really feeling hopeless. It's not even about their income. It's we're so so much. Each of us is in our own little silo, and we only know these people. We don't have a group around us that has a diversity of opinions. And so that's one of the things that I think food and the kind of stuff your show, when I listen to it in the morning, really helps reach out and make people realize commonalities. And so I'm really happy to be here and listen to you in person today.
Hey, thank you.
And you're online too, so.
Yeah, anyone can get us online, get our podcast anytime.
Right.
And right now, we're hoping to change that pretty soon, but right now you do have to go to AM 950, and you may need to put in the a zip code 55414, or you Food Freedom Radio, but you need the AM 950, and you should be able to get it, but we're hoping to improve that soon.
The other question I have is, should I close the door?
I don't know. I have a very loud voice, so I don't know if I need it.
Hi, good morning. My name is Liana Gale. I'm from here, from the suburb of Roseville. I'm originally from Germany, and when I was a teenager, I actually went around with my little motorbike and collected herbs. I was kind of interested in medicinal plants, and there's a rich history in Germany, on medicinal plants. And then I studied horticulture, and then actually I did research in agriculture, so I came here to work at the University of Minnesota, agricultural research. But the reason I'm here is kind of what I'm kind of doing now. I became an activist 5 years ago, and I've studied economics and politics, and I came to support the idea of a basic income, which would give every person enough money to afford a dignified life without means testing or work requirement, and then we would get around all these issues we kind of mentioned. People would have time, which would lead probably to more local food production. I really feel that there, especially here, I mean, that's where I kind of have my experiences, people are more and more interested in kind of growing their own food. I mean, there's such a movement on urban agriculture here. Farmers market, I've been to the farmers markets. It's wonderful to be here and kind of eat all the richness of the vegetables and fruits that are produced here. And I've seen an increase over the last 15 years in visits to the farmers market. And it's just kind of really amazing. So if we just kind of could take care of each other, I think then the food issue is kind of being solved. I think people don't want to buy cheap food. I think it's a matter of economics and how do we kind of fix the economics to kind of fulfill our human needs. I mean, our human needs should be kind of be at the center of economics to make sure that we are all okay. And I have been on Laura's program. She's a supporter.
Where in Germany?
I'm from the Black Forest, southwest.
Freiburg. Don Olson, I'm from Minneapolis, and I do a lot with KFI Community Radio. And I've been involved with the food co-ops since they began in 1970. This is where the new wave of co-ops began. It was right around here. We have a lot of them here. We also have a lot of all the new copycats from the corporate world who are crowding in, all the way Ivy's, Whole Foods, to several other chains, Fresh Time. There's all of them that come around here there because there's quite a bit of food consciousness which has developed since then. I've been a member of a community-supported agriculture for 25 years. And so this Minneapolis, Minnesota and Wisconsin are kind of epicenter of a lot of the, where the CSAs are, Madison especially, and other areas too, but around the Twin Cities. And so our CSA is in western Wisconsin. We have to go out there and harvest at least once a year, which is different than many of the CSAs. I think you develop a much stronger identification then with the farmers, and you see exactly what goes on.
I was going to do this later, but it just feels like I want to do it right now. I happen to have inherited the 1929 Articles of Corporation for a small Finnish co-op. And so I'm just going to pass it around to try to get some of its aura going here. But here's a statement. So the business and purpose of this association should be to conduct a general mercantile enterprise on the cooperative plan to purchase and produce
for sale all kinds of merchandise and keep same for sale at prevailing market rates, including the manufacture and sale of cheese, butter, and other dairy products for milk supplied by its patrons, and the shipping and marketing of all kinds of farm produce from its patrons cooperatively. So just to kind of get its vibes going. And then I don't know if I have enough of these. If I don't, I have some of the general ones, but I'm happy to email and pass. So this will just, what's going around that larger one, I'm just going to orally present this information kind of quickly. So for those who weren't here, I started off talking a little bit about chlorophyophis, and somewhere in there is the letter from the Academy of Pediatrics. And if we're talking to conservative neighbors, the Academy of Pediatrics says chlorophyophis causes brain damage in babies. That information needs to get out in small towns and in churches. It causes brain damage. And the response from the company is, but it's working, it's a leading pesticide. And I will basically say that's just zombie-ish. It's just not living, it's not being responsive. So the consequence of the current extractive farm system, it's propelled by increasingly powerful transnational is really important, transnational food industry. It's responsible for about half of all produced greenhouse gas emissions in the system, and there's a lot of reasons for that. And on the other hand, Marie Rodell said, I continue to tell people that climate change is a gift. This is Mother Nature's way of letting us know she is sick. We have broken our ecological systems, and only we can fix them. I have data that suggests that a global transition to a regenerative organic agriculture can reverse climate change.
That's right. That's your.
And that's and so I mean the basic way, if no one understands, trees are great for the planet. You know, they like absorb all this carbon, and long black fields are not good. So the monocultural approach is really bad. So environmental effects about our dominant food system. Nearly 1 billion pounds of pesticides are used every day. We know that the 1 billion. We know that the population of bees, butterflies, bats, and frogs have been declining. Bird populations are affected. Invertebrates, frogs, and but anyhow,
invertebrates.
Thank you. One study estimated that we have degraded more than 7.5 million square miles of land. So our species, in other words, we're rapidly trashing an area the size of the United States and Canada combined. And the sad thing is that's probably, figure it's very outdated, it's probably far worse than that. The other chart I have here is the chart showing extinction of species and how that mirrors human. You can look at that. So the food system's impact on water, farm runoff. So the dead zones, how many people here know about dead zones? And then even in Toledo, there was a big water crisis they didn't have any water for 400,000 residents, and that was related to how they were doing food. Atrazine, how many people here know about atrazine? Atrazine, approximately 75% of stream water and 40% of all groundwater samples from agricultural area tested in an extensive U.S. geological survey contained atrazine. And the first time I saw this, I was actually traveling in Wisconsin, and one of the restaurants says, don't drink this water because of atrazine. So... Here's a nice fact. There is more plastic in the ocean than plankton.
And that's
plankton. So plankton, of course, is the fundamental of the ocean system. Animal waste is the largest contributor to pollution. 60% of rivers and streams are classified as impaired. And, California represents only less than 2% of our country's cropland, but in dollar terms, it produces almost half of our fruits and nuts. And so, the conditions in California, it's a very fragile food system. It's very fragile, and that's scary. It's also incredibly unjust. 1 in 6 jobs has something to do with food, and 85% of these do not pay a livable wage. This is from Food Workers Alliance. I mean, your McDonald workers, the farm workers. And just it's a very unjust system. PBS did something about rape in the field. 70% of our food is harvested by immigrants. Thank an immigrant. You like cheap food? Thank an immigrant. But the other thing about our food system is it's highly, highly concentrated. Between 1960 and 2000, the number of farms declined from 3.2 million to 1.9 million, while the average size increased by 40%. And again, this statistic's way outdated. I mean, we know this is happening. The farms are getting bigger and bigger, and fewer and fewer. And the four largest meatpacking companies went from controlling 28% of the market in 1980 to over 70% in 2007. Mm-hmm. Now again, this fact is getting worse and worse. And even one of the large companies, Smithfield, got bought out by the China conglomerate, so China is now owning most of the pork. So in the state of Minnesota, we have the manure equivalent as if we had 50 million people here, because we have a large pork industry. And all that manure is going in the water of our children and grandchildren, and all the profits are going out to China because they're eating more of our pork. And from the money system, from that other system, I think the name zombie system works. From that zombie system, this is progress. To me, it's like, you're dead, man. You know, you're just not. But the top 15 global supermarkets account for more than 30% of the world's supermarket. And I'm glad someone else pointed out that there's some real fakers out there. In fact, I heard an interview from. But he was basically saying this company is like, if it wasn't for this company, maybe we wouldn't have had organic. It's like, if it wasn't for that company, there would be decentralized with a bunch of locally owned things. So don't go telling me your one and only big guy out here is some friggin' hero, because I don't believe it. So, but here's a cool quote from a Land Stewardship Project. Anybody here familiar with the Land Stewardship Project? They're a great local group here. Small cell farmers are more efficient. When only yields of one or two crops is considered, large farms are more productive. However, when economists look at total output, grains, fruit, animals, products, forage, etc., of a particular farm, smaller, more diverse operations win hand down. And just like with the climate crisis, we're going to win this in the marketplace. That's why I know some people have been like saying, I'm anti-capitalism. I'm like, no, we need capitalism, but we need real capitalism, person-to-person capitalism,
right.
So we can
people
readjust
capitalism.
For stupid living
people.
Capitalism,
people.
Maybe.
Yes, or people.
But so then the extractive food systems impact on personal health. So the vast majority of the food produced is highly processed, untested chemicals, questionable additives. There's been a dramatic increase in food allergies, right? I mean, we didn't hear about peanut allergies. The cancer, the autism, the gut problems. These health costs, they're tied to our food. Even food labeled organic can have additives, carrageenan. And, you know, right now, I love the organic label. It came out from a really good struggle, but unfortunately, it's becoming co-opted.
Yep.
You know, it just is. And, but diabetes is dramatically increasing, predicted to affect 1 in 3 Americans, and communities of color at greater risk. Studies have suggested that pesticides could increase the risk of leukemia, brain tumors, cancer, prostate cancer. How many people here know someone who's ill or died of cancer? All right. Mm-hmm. Antidepressants such as Prozac have become the most prescribed medicines, even more medicines than hypertension, pain, and heart disease. And if anyone knows anyone dealing with chemistry, with issues of anxiety and depression, which is at an epidemic right now, really encourage them to check out Henry Emmons. He's got a couple books called The Chemistry of Calm and The Joy of Calm. So, and his name's here, but he's got some wonderful books, and he's local, but he's got some great books out there. Equity issue. This is a really sad one. There is an 8-year lifespan difference in the Twin Cities based on zip code.
Oh.
Zip code. So, and this comes from Walder, which is a very respected local group. A black kid raised in North Minneapolis compared to a white kid in an affluent suburb, 8 years difference. Now, to have some compassion to some of the Trump voters, I don't remember the counties or anything, but sometimes I think the longevity of Trump voters might also be a lot lower than the votes than that too. I mean, I think it's one of the key indicators of inequity that doesn't get talked about enough is lifespan. You know, we know that eating fruits and vegetables can dramatically improve health, and yet fruits and vegetables are considered too expensive. I mean, how stupid is this? Really, how stupid is it? I mean, we're spending all this money on healthcare. And it's like,
it only grows on trees.
I know, it's crazy. One in four African American households experience some food insecurity as compared to 1 in 10 of Caucasian white households. This in food insecurity, I mean, what are we missing? Does the sun not shining enough? Do we not have enough seeds? Do we not have enough dirt? And what are we missing? You know, why? And I think that food insecurity is directly linked to the money system. In fact, we did interview this guy who did a book on Big Hunger, the hunger groups feeding, they're actually funded heavily by Walmart. And it's interesting how we try to tackle that. GMOs. When GMOs were introduced, this was supposed to be the big hero. We're not going to have to use any more pesticides. We have GMOs now, so this is going to take away our pesticides, and we're going to be really good environmental people. Oh my gosh, are we great? But this technology has resulted from 400 million more pounds of pesticides being used. And nature is smart. I mean, we keep thinking that humans have got it made, and humility works. That's alive in every one of our religious and philosophy teachings. Mm-hmm. But we have lost that sense of humility and reverence for the natural world. And so with the genetic modified foods, the herbicide-resistant crops. Anyone heard about superweeds?
No.
You know, and I've talked to some farmers. These superweeds are really bad because they're... that nature's gonna win. but it is really sad. So, and I have a quote from Bill Nye, the science guy. You know that you can know what happens to any individual species that you modify. You cannot be certain what will happen to the ecosystem. Also, we have a strange situation where we have malnourished fat people. It's not that we need more food; it's that we need to manage our food system better. And then antibiotics, you know, about 80% of the antibiotics used in the United States are used for farm animals. And I know there's been some really horrible movies and horrible stories.
But you won't find small farmers doing that because they can't afford to do that. They only treat their animals when they're sick.
Right, right. Small farmers are the way to go.
They can't afford that.
Yeah. So now, what did I miss? That's just kind of, we can just go around and talk for a little bit. So it's 10 o'clock, I want to be cognizant of time. Well, just 5 minutes, popcorn style, what else you want to say about the problems?
Yeah, when you were saying your list, I kept thinking, all of these problems that you're talking about, if you look historically, they're political problems. They're monetary and political. And one of the things I learned from NORM, from the National Organization of Raw Materials, see, NORM was developed in the 30s, and it was started by a farmer who was wiped out because the farm prices went from like $2 to a dollar for whatever he was producing. And he said, there's always these people that say, I want to know why this happened. And he went out and he found out with the help of some farm economists, and they got a law in Congress from 1942 to 1952 called parity price. And what that did was, for every farmer, commodity farmer in the U.S., this was a congressional law, there was a price set for that crop by the U.S. government. So anybody who wanted to come, whether an international buyer or a domestic buyer, had to pay 1 cent above that parity price. And what that did, it gave farmers in this country a decent income. And that income, like I was saying before, I learned this all from NORM. If the farmer gets a decent income, he's able to buy that tractor. He's able to go to his local retail stores and buy what he needs for his farm. He's able to give his labor, when it's not his family, to give his labor a decent salary. And that all flows through the rest of the economy. we wouldn't have manufacturing if we did not have our farmers and...
If we look at that basic shape, so, and it says, so the local impact of the, which one it is, let me make sure. So for every $1,000 spent at a co-op, $1,600 goes in the local economy. This
yes.
is regenerative. This is
yes.
the water cycle. This is living economics.
Yes, it starts down there
yeah.
at the farm.
Right.
That's where it starts. We're not taught that. We're not
no.
taught that. So what happened was that law in Congress is in Congress. In 1950, the early 1950s, the free trade mentality, the people in Washington brought in free trade into this country. And that law went out and the price for our farm products from 1952 to the present. In 1952, the farmer was given 100% of what he should get for his product. And it slowly went down and the farm started bankrupting. Today, our farmers are getting 34% of what they should get. Now, what does that mean for the rest of the economy? Because that income from the farmer is not getting into the rest of the economy. So we're all in debt to get income to get our basic needs met, and we're looking cheap. Everything we have to do is cheap, but it starts with the farmer.
Yeah.
And it's a political issue.
What was that, the acronym again? What does that stand for?
NORM.
National Organization of Raw Materials.
So thank you.
I have a handout.
And the thing about NORM is it was started by Charles Walters, head of Acres USA, was a president. And he was a trained economist, and there is a formula that shows that that this Wilkins person developed to show the relationship between national income and farm income, and we have to understand, in other words, how the economy works. And with what we're talking about, the NEED Act, it's going to help get the farmer some national income. So the system is.
We want to make sure we leave plenty of time to try to figure out how to solve the problem. But Jerry, you had something, and then we got to just.
Yeah, the small farmer is the one getting killed, but big ag is getting massive subsidies from the federal government. How do we get rid of those?
Great question. Yeah. Okay, I want to just, I think I really want to try to take a pause before I move on to the solutions and just be quiet. I'm not even going to try to get anything. Just be quiet in a few minutes and take that pause. Just hope it'll make sense. Just feel whatever we're feeling. Hand out some tomatoes. Did you want to say something?
Oh no, I'm stretching.
Oh, good for you. I'm gonna hand out some tomatoes, and I'm not even gonna try to hide which ones. Feel free to taste some. The orange ones I picked from my garden this morning, except for two or three that were yesterday's. But and this I picked up at a gas station. I really even this is a garden in a greenhouse in Mexico. I'm not sure it's bad or anything, but see if you sense a difference between these two plants. And then the other thing I have. Wait later on with this peach. Yeah, I don't know if I have enough for everyone, but I do know after this is done, if people want to, there is a little West Bank community garden only a block away, and there
oh, wow.
is at least 20 cherry tomatoes sitting there. I checked it out. Yeah, so we can do this little act of just picking tomatoes.
Wow.
And I'll pass around, especially in the light, and I don't, obviously, I have... My peach tree only produces like 10 peaches, but it's a young tree, and it's in Minneapolis. It's in a suburb in Minneapolis, and because I think that and so and I let me see how many copies I have. This I have plenty. I have plenty of one of the basics of this, but so I don't know if I have enough of that. Again, I want to. One of the big hopes I have is the zero going into the inner body. The zero. So briefly, in permaculture, they talk about different zones. So this kind of played off the zone. But where there's,
you can
so
tell the difference.
Yeah,
you
can
really
you tell
can.
The difference?
Yeah,
yeah,
I love tomatoes.
Yeah.
These are really sweet.
put it on the quote on their email. I'm like, I tried to track down that person to find the quote, but I couldn't find the exact quote. I think a couple people have said things. But if people are able to really taste food again, taste is what, because the innate body knows. Our body knows a lot more than we think. And so there's, on this little thing, there's like, on Oprah did this little thing with Eckhart Tolle, who I absolutely adore, and he's just how to eat consciously. He did this as a little two-minute video. There's something else I like, it's called the Presencing Institute. So it's this idea of sensing and being in the present. So coming alive to the present moment, and then also our sensing, which might be our natural indigenous ways. That's what I would think. Another thing I like is this Food Matters TV. They do a lot of free things on this stuff. So that's trying to really come alive to our bodies. And, you know, if I name it a zombie system, you know, what does it mean to come alive to our bodies? And the hope, because you're talking about not having hope. You know, there is a place where hope never dies. And that is, that is trying to find that place. Mm-hmm. And it was fun doing this presentation because I never thought about this until now, mm-hmm. but this zone one was this hand-to-mouth movement. Now, this is how we ate. This is the animal alive. This is, if you had a ruler of our time on the planet, I mean, you know, all of that time, we ate with this little movement. And because I practiced permaculture in my yard my husband born, he's Finnish, hence the Finnish things, but, so I get food from my regular suburban yard all the time. I can't feed myself, I'm not self-sufficient, but, and we can talk more later on if we want about the types of things I grow, I'll finish this. So learning to sense the difference between eating food grown in living soils versus food grown in zombie soil. Now, for me, because I eat so much organic, if I'm at a restaurant, I was like, that's broccoli? Yuck. What's that? That's not broccoli. I know that. But here's the thing that's also really fun. What type of food, what type of soil the food was grown in is key, because the world is far more complex than humans are able to understand with our minds. There are trillions of microbes in our gut. And historically, this is a quote, scientists believe that soil microbes were broadly similar around the world, from Asia to South America. More recent work has revealed that microbial populations are actually hyperlocal. And that's from an article in the Smithsonian magazine. And the article goes on to say 80% of the soil microbes in Central Park are still undescribed. There's a lot of diversity to be reckoned with. And so, again, humility works. Our understanding of what life is, one of the futurists said, by the time I finish the sentence, the world will have changed. I mean, we are just, the knowledge source that's going on is just skyrocketing. And so the knowledge about the microbiome, has anyone here, how many people here have heard of the phrase microbiome? Okay, because so the microbiome is key. We are actually a microbiome in a microbiome, and I don't know the site, but our heads alone can't know what food is good, but our body wisdom can know. And engaging with our inner body wisdom, eating from level soils, is the key to changing the ramifications of the sixth mass extinction on the planet. So the rest of this we can get into. So zone two is acquire food. What food can I personally grow or retain? What food can I get without using money? And I know Leanne and I might talk, we went to the thing on Bitcoin, but what food can I get in my life not using money? Just avoid the industrial system. That's the author of the book, The Local Food Revolution, How Humanity Will Feed Itself in Uncertain Times, Michael Brownlee. But he's in Boulder, Colorado, and a group of local activists got together and they set the goal of having 25% of their food local. And when they set that goal, whatever they were working on 15 years ago, I thought, oh, that's easy peasy, 25% of the goal, local food. And it was much, much harder than they thought. Now, they August 6th to the 16th, they have a free The Local Food Summit online.com. So just to get people together to talk about this. But yeah, and but because getting food within the system relies on dollars determined by the system, about 1 in 7 Americans experience food insecurity.
Local food.
The local food. Yeah, the local food summit.com. So communities, examples of food-free food is box garden, parks, permaculture, food forest, foraging, indoor gardening, I mean, because there are renters, and some indoor gardening, people growing microgreens, community garden, informal food sharing. Is there a place that people can trade their time for food? Can we start businesses that help people have food businesses? Can we find new sustainable ways to prepare food business? And so I do a lot with chives and eggs, you know, chives and eggs and whatever else is available. It's really simple and really cheap. And how do I use my money to get food grown in ethical ways from living soil? So how do I actually use my money? And I have a chart there, and it's really interesting. Most dollars are now spent in restaurants, not eating at home.
Wow.
But to kind of get to that, you know, comment someone said earlier, it's like, well, yeah, people always want the cheapest food. It's like, yeah, well, what's the rest of their life they're experiencing? You know, people don't know how to cook, and you know, we just have to respect this. We have to have respect and compassion for what's going on and find ways of hacking it. So at AM950, we have this little thing going, Eat Local Minnesota, so we advertise just restaurants. The only restaurants that advertise on AM950 are locally owned. And so my personal Zone 3 work is, where can I use my money to get food from living soils? And I mentioned the P6. But also, what type of food? And this is where there's some real potential. And I'm going to pass this around. Now, number one, I don't like ConAgra. Number two, they say this organic, they're lying. But what's interesting about it is that it's rice, it's grains and legumes with vegetables. You know, we all have seen so many changes in the food system, right? I mean, Google did not exist a long time ago. If we, as Americans, ate more lentils, we would solve so many problems. And lentils are really good. I mean, there's a great book out there called The Lentil Underground. You can go to it and see their video and stuff. And so it was these farmers, and they got tired of the wheat farm, the whole system. And this, I heard him speak, it was great. It was like, I know, I mean, it was harder than hell. I mean, I want to put that out there. It was hard. But now they've got a little co-op, and they have the governor of Montana, John Tesler, is that right? I don't remember, but I think it's John Tesler, but he's involved in it. And so they have converted, and they're trying to, Montana's got great soil for growing lentils. And, in case you don't know, lentils are, they feed the soil. They don't need it, they feed the soil there, and they're very good for you.
What kind of climate do they like?
They don't need much rain, so they don't do well where there's rain. And so, and that's that whole idea of hyper-local. I mean, I've talked to farmers too. I mean, this part of my land's very different than that part of my land, you know? So that's, I mean, it's complicated, but legumes and grains and eating that, and I couldn't find the source from this, but the person who told me it is a pioneer, I like her, and I was just didn't have time to find it, So a vegan diet, a meat-eating diet requires 17 times more land than a vegan diet. So the local food shed, so what can I do to shift the local food system? And here's some of the things going on. And, you know, I did pass that co-op thing. And, you know, at the time that those people came up with that, there was no paths. I mean, they were forging a new path, right? Yeah?
What are we supposed to see on here?
Oh, I guess the thing that I wanted to point out with that is the idea of how food is changing, that it is rice and legumes and vegetables. And then the thing I was thinking about later on is, can we be doing our own companies that will make food like that?
Okay.
I mean, can we, how do we hack the system? So,
go back to mom and pop.
Go back to mom and pops, yeah. And if we can find, and this is something I'm going to throw out. I mean, obviously I have weight issues. I haven't figured it out myself. And one of the things I wanted to do for a long time is start a food business, and I haven't figured that out either. But, you know, what do we do? But how do we shift the local food system? Working with the neighbors. There was a great transition town. Anyone familiar with transition towns?
Mm-hmm.
We had a transition town gathering. So, check out transition towns. there's this Leslie McKenzie. She went to something in 2010 and got really upset about climate change and then learned about transition towns. And she now has 26 box gardens in her yard. She invites the little school with indigenous kids over every Wednesday to go look at the bees. They now have 3 events going in their neighborhood every month. They have like a home brewers club, and they're just, but in the transition town is a theory that just, you know, open up the space. It's not like this is the plan, this is what you got to do, but it's like, just figure it out, man. You know, they have some resources, but that transition town and trying to get together with neighbors. And just as an example, I put out a little email when I'm going to hand out my peach. What the heck, so you can just smell it a little bit.
We did.
You know what I could do? You know what I should do?
I reframe it so people can see it on my live stream.
Oh, how cool is that? Because you know what we could do.
I wish they could smell it, though.
Yeah. Yeah, we could maybe do a contest or something. I don't know.
The person that wins gets to eat peach.
Yeah, so, but even with that peach, you know, if my neighbors were to plant peach trees, it would help mine produce more.
Yes.
And so I sent an email out to my neighbors, you know, and I live in a mixed area, but I was very sensitive. I mean, I was like, Lori, you're kind of strong, so chill out a little bit. By the way, chloroform causes brain damage according to baby doctors. So please don't feed your kids peaches, but I have a peach tree, and if you plant more, you may get peaches too. So and work with the park system. And here's, so just a month ago, the Minneapolis Park and Rec Board adopted the urban agriculture plan. And quote, the growth of healthy local food systems. The activity plan addresses board policy, facilities, and services to better support food-related activities within the park. And we have a local member here, Russ Henry. He's very familiar with soil conditions, and he's been pushing the parks to not use chemicals and start this food forest. Again, it's not easy. It takes time, but it's really fun. Work with the state. I mean, the Minnesota has a great Minnesota Grown program. They put out a guide so people can, there's a wholesale directory. And then work with the organizations, social enterprises, and businesses to support the local food shed. And there's just a lot of really fun activity going on here. And then the other zone, so my personal zone for work is, can I start a food business? And I went to a seminar, and I was actually kind of surprised on this. But under the Minnesota Food Cottage Laws, I can make $18,000, and it's only a $50 licensing fee that I need. Obviously, then you need to do the paperwork. It's not quite that simple, but it's in terms of the food licensing part. And the Minnesota Department of the Extension Service, which has been great, they're putting all their resources online, so what you need to do. And the workshop I went to was $50 and was 4 hours and spent a lot of time on how to wash your hands.
That's a good deal. It costs about $200, I think, to get the cottage industry license in Texas.
Oh, okay.
I'm not positive, but yeah, I know.
Well, and the other thing I liked about that is she was saying it's $18,000, but it's $18,000 per household. So if you and your spouse and maybe even a kid got in there, you know, and you
per
have
person,
something, and,
per house,
and
per
so
person.
I'll give, I mean, you know, I passed that, pass this thing around. Is there some way people need cheap, affordable food? So can I have a container, the tomato products are here. I have the tomato product, and then I have a little package of lentils and a little package of grains, but it's all sort of crock-pot ready. Crock-pot ready foods that I could be selling to people, you know, how to try to hack that system, which is what I want to do. And I have a fun story on this zone forward. So there's Eureka Compass Vegan Food, and he just completed his Kickstarter program. He's asked for $25,000. He got 110% of that. But what he did is he's a vegan activist. And he saw that there was a pizza shop blocks away from his house that didn't open till 3, so he knocked on the door and said, you know, what if I worked here in the mornings and did a breakfast, vegan breakfast coffee shop, and then when you're closed on Mondays, I'll do like this gourmet vegan deal. And they're like, yeah, that sounds great. So he worked that out. And then that company went out, but now he's going to open up his own. And one of the things he said about that is he doesn't want any employees, like 16,000. He's not looking, I'm going to be the king of the vegan empire. You know, he's just looking for a simple day-to-day moment. Yeah, so I was just talking about the vegan so I just was mentioning Eureka Compass Vegan Food, and so how he started his own vegan business. And then the zone five is the massive global and policy issues around food, okay? And we could be talking for a long time. But I think the number one work in the, that we need is developing compassion. And so I have a just a really regular photo of a pig. And when I was on the hog farmers, I was shocked. They had all these pictures about, look how great we are. I'm like, can you not even see the suffering in the eyes? Can you not see that? I mean, I keep talking about zombie culture, and they were like, look at all these great pictures. You know, but again, how I go into my own self is, you know, where is that compassion, that developing compassion? But the current food system is based on suffering. Suffering of the soil, suffering of the environment, suffering of the animals, suffering of the people working on it. And eating is a joyful act.
Or could be. I wrote down, you know, we all need these times apart to stop thinking about what we're doing every day and just be present. And it occurred to me, slow down, chew, and taste every time I sit before a plate of food, because that's not the way we eat very often.
Yeah, that's great.
Good.
So I've got three little things, and then I'm just gonna, we can go in a circle and just talk or do whatever we want. So the other thing is the farm bill is crap. You know, it's taxpayers heavily subsidized corn, soy, two crops, meat process. It just doesn't make any sense. So this is from Washington Post. Does almost nothing from fruits and vegetables, which we're supposed to eat more of. Is there any obligation to spend the public's money in a way that is consistent with the same public's health? You know, it's integrating this health and the system instead of just all working in these silos. The other thing I'm very afraid of, I am definitely afraid of this, is the biotech trade industry. So their new slogan is, quote this, heal the world, fuel the world, feed the world. So if you have salmon that grow twice as fast in half the time,
yeah,
that's feeding the goddamn zombies. That's not feeding the living world.
Well, you're feeding them grain, you're not feeding them the protein sources that they normally eat.
Right. And then you can have apples that don't turn brown. Arctic apple, I mean, and so did when they first came out with their GMO stuff, they promised to reduce pesticide use. It did not go down, it went up. And right now we're dealing with the rapid emergence of resistant weeds. Again, I'm gonna start out, there are trillions of microbes in our gut. Life is so much more complicated than humans can comprehend with our mind only. We need to come alive to our senses. And I mean, in some ways, you know, there are some wonderful organizations out there, IATP and Seed Savers, but I mean, in some ways we are really weak politically. And so I think one of the most powerful things we can do is gain money in the resources, or being able to eat without the money. But if we can gain, if we can create this, and I'll give an optimistic example, like local beer here is just taking off like crazy. And so the Beverage Association says that they've made 400,000 jobs. Yeah, 400,000 jobs. And then not only, I mean, here's some trickle down. So this guy grew up with a couple acres. His dad had a couple acres. And he's now doing
hops.
He's doing hops. So I don't remember, it's Eric Sanderud. And he has a hop farm. And so he's providing all the hops for that. And then there's also a factory, you guys are staying extra time, there's the Hoppy Trolley, so they do tours of the Northeast businesses. And so, I mean, it's a living economy. And going back to the Eureka Compass thing, I mean, he was all about being alive and just chilling out and making the world better for the next generation, right? So I did get through all of my materials. We have as much time. Actually, next thing doesn't start till noon, but technically we're supposed to be done at 4:45. And then I thought if anyone wanted to, we could actually walk to the community garden and eat tomatoes right off. So, but feel free to, let's just talk about how we make something better.
I just wanted to interject something here about the meat-eating diet requires 17 times more land than a vegan diet. This is one of the areas I concentrated on in my book, because that's within the modern paradigm. A lot of...
Oh, true.
So there's something called regenerative agriculture, which helps rebuild the land, and it requires intensive, something called intensive grazing management, which is a subsection, I think it's related to permaculture. It's another form of permaculture. And it helps rebuild the soil, it helps rebuild the water systems. There's a farmer, celebrity farmer, by the name of Joel Salatin that I talk about in my book. Mm-hmm. And he's able to, if you extrapolate out, he's able to produce on his 150 acres enough food to feed, I think, if we extrapolated it out for the current system for animals is, you know, the animals, first of all, are excluded from the animal welfare laws, and they're fed grain. So that takes up, I forget how many acres of land. So if you pull that out of the equation and let these animals do it intensive grazing management style, you're rebuilding the soil, you're putting the carbon back in the soil, and you're making healthier animals, healthier plants doing that. So they're going to give you more protein. So he can provide, extrapolated out, if farmers like him could feed, I think 20 to 26 billion people per year with nutrient-dense food.
Right.
And that's, you know, and then you've got the extra land left over where you can produce these ancient grains, you know, lentils and all of that stuff. So, I mean, we could feed the world several times over if we, and we can, this is where the carbon, we're mining the carbon out of our soils, and we need to figure out ways to put it back in. So that was.
I'm really glad you made that point, because I know a lot of people, agroecology, a lot of people say that we need farm animals, we just not the industrial system.
Exactly.
Industrial system,
right.
But like the chickens poop and provide the nutrients and.
Yeah, and that's yeah. kind of the Salatin's method is interesting to listen to or figure out. There's others, like there's this guy, Alan Savoy, he does Savoy. He does TED Talks where he talks about Zimbabwe and where they got into the green business, and then they went, little pockets of it went into cattle raising, but they didn't do it the right way, and then they come in, this Alan guy comes in, and they do intensive grazing management, and they started rebuilding the water systems. It was, you know, desert. And then you saw where you get some green foliage in these areas. So there's a lot of people associated with acres that go around doing these talks and are doing the same
right.
kinds of things.
What's the name of the book?
Oh, my book, Climate Change, Land Use, and Monetary Policy.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That links, that's linking the money system
yeah.
with how the land is being pushed in a certain direction.
Talk about Mesopotamia, because that's a good example.
Yeah, it goes back to Mesopotamia
still,
and our Dust Bowl.
You're still writing it, or?
No. It's
it's available?
Yeah.
Tell us one more time.
Climate Change, Land Use, and Monetary Policy, and the author Geraldine Perry.
Okay.
And it's at Amazon.
Okay, thanks.
Cool.
Can I do a follow-up?
Sure.
One of the things that I keep telling people is go to your local library and ask for that book. They only have so much money.
Right.
And you can, you know, you can look up the ISBN number so that they do all the work for them. And it doesn't matter if it's that book, maybe it's some other book, but if they don't get people who ask
right.
and get a lot of people to ask, then you're not going to, they can't justify ordering it, because mm-hmm. the romance novel, at least in the Indianapolis system, win almost all the dollars.
Yeah.
One year it was
Thank you. Are you a librarian? Or were you a librarian?
No, but I love the library because it's a community place.
Yeah.
But the other follow-on is, I think I heard you saying that we could feed 26
billion
people.
Billion
people. But I'd like you to think back when you're saying that to those tomato examples. You know, local security, food security is what makes you, and we've talked about that, you've talked about it a lot over the years, but now, today. So, promoting us moving our food overseas.
Pardon me?
Promoting that somehow we could support them. We want to emphasize that the local people can support themselves with
mm-hmm.
the help of
That's what I tried to do. That's
yeah.
exactly
but
what I tried to do.
What I heard you saying wasn't
was that?
No, I cover the other parts of the land where it can be used for vegetables and you know, in there too.
For export.
Yeah.
No.
Geraldine is suggesting that each country can do that, be self-sufficient for themselves, basically.
Yeah.
I pointed out.
Which helps all economies.
Yes.
Everyone's
absolutely.
Boat.
Yeah.
I just want to give my vegan perspective, I guess. There's a really good website called Chomping Climate Change. And it's basically run by one of the analysts at the World Bank who analyzed the impact of animal agriculture on climate change. It turns out, though, that it takes at least 3 acres per cow for grazing. And if you just do the arithmetic, it's just not enough land area in the U.S. to support our increasing demand.
But Paul, that's on the current model. That's on the current model because Salatin does it on 150 acres, and I forget how many cattle he raises.
Yeah.
And he gets cow days per acre, and he builds the soil.
Right. That may be, but grass-fed people get this warm feeling going for grass-fed, but it's really only for the more affluent who can afford that.
Right, yeah.
So that's why it's sustainable now, because there aren't that many people who can afford it. But if we transfer over to a fully grass-fed model, notwithstanding that.
I, by the way, I switched, my dogs are now eating vegan food, Evolution pet food here locally. And I was, even my husband, who's a lifetime vegetarian, I do eat meat, and I try to be very conscious, so I think it's less meat. And as far as chickens, I know, but Main Street Project is doing some good work. But I tried, and Ferndale turkey, so I try to be, and I try to limit it to like, you know, a couple days a week, not 7 days a week. But the dogs love the vegan dog food. I was really surprised.
There is, so I come, our food group is Weston Price. I don't know if you've heard of him.
Oh, sure.
All right. So that's part of my website has, I just did, redid the pH balance. I've got a segment on pH balance, and it's citing the studies that have been done over the last, metadata studies that have been done with links. For the last, I think about 20 years, and because there is some kind of a, I always wondered with what Weston Price was talking about when he was saying that his thesis was, it wasn't a thesis, he researched all this, and he wasn't the only one, that animal foods, you could call them insects, you would do whatever, but animal foods and fats are an important part of the diet. They build bones and all the other things. So, I go take you through that, and what is our problem is the grains and the starches in our diet, the white stuff, sugar, that's what's, anyway, it goes through the healthadvantage.com, go look at the pH balance, and it's a fairly long.
Well, I go back to that, what we understand about soils, it's hyper localized and whatever we do.
I didn't know anything when I came here. I didn't know how much I didn't know, and I still don't even know how much I work. And I don't tell anybody, but I skipped tracks, sessions, conferences, and went to what appealed to me, and what I learned, I'm blown away, and I'm going to take home. The system can't change till the monetary system changes.
That's right.
Can't change till we adopt that 28th Amendment. That's the take home I'm taking away from this whole thing. Whether you want to be vegan or you want to eat meat, I eat meat that's grown locally, butchered locally, humanely, whatever. But when people are forced to not be able to obtain food,
that's
an economic problem. And as much as we believe in eating the right foods, and I do 100%, I grow my own tomatoes, etc., etc., but people around me can't afford it.
That's right.
And I want to make sure I get a little time for something.
Quick point. Our organization fought bottled water.
Oh, good.
we sued Perrier and got them out of our state. And moved on.
Wow.
But the point is, we need to really educate people ourselves. Mm-hmm. Like, just an example, I'm sitting at a session earlier today, or yesterday, and we're talking about water and doing things in the community. Just one of our partners here was sitting with a bottle of Fiji water. That water travels 5,000 miles.
I know, I was actually surprised.
You know, I almost stood up and said something. My wife would have. She would. We need to educate ourselves, yeah, like we said, on the assumptions that we
have. Well, Ed, I don't know if I'm going to be able to pull this one off, but you had something really interesting you said about baptism. And when you said that, is how do we educate without pissing people off, right?
Yeah.
I mean, how do you, and so if we can find that skill, you know, I think it would be more effective. And for me, it's sort of like trying not to adapt a story, but trying to come at it. And that's not cultural. I mean, I don't know if anyone noticed, but that's not even popular with the president anymore.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
But yeah, so that's great. And I know you had a comment. And
okay, my dad was a small farmer, like I've said before, 230 acres. He and Mom had it paid for, and yet the most my dad ever made on his farm, free and clear, believe it or not, was $3,000
a
year. That's why we don't have small farmers.
Yeah.
They
that's
cannot
right.
survive
that's
on
right.
the land.
That's right.
I'm so glad you said that, because you know we can sit here in the head, and that's why I said the head alone is not going to solve this, because and the head's not alone going to solve it. And I had a farmer tell me, because where I think the solution, and then I think I'm going to even jump in here with Leanne, because the solution is how can we get food that people will eat very easily using ingredients so that farmer gets more money, and that we can somehow collaborate and create a different economic system.
That's
and so I just did, because we want to talk, because there was kind of an exciting stuff going on Bitcoin or local currency. And so, because the whole system is not set up, it's not an equal playing field. I mean, in anything, what it takes to, when I go to the farmer's market, I'm like, wow, this is so cheap. And I know other people, I live in a trailer home, I can't afford that, you know? I mean,
we got to get big ag out.
But in Kentucky, at the Kentucky Proud Farmer's Market, which run from, I don't know, February, I think, to November, it is local people. There, if it comes out of county, they must be a county that touches the county where they're selling. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is that you can actually go to this farmer's farm and see what he's doing. Mm-hmm. You can actually talk to him and see, are you using sprays?
Yep.
Are you farming organically? So one of the best pieces of advice I can give anybody who's wanting to eat good food, know your farmer.
Mm-hmm. Know your farmer.
Right.
That's right.
And they actually charge more than the grocery stores charge for the food. But they do accept food vouchers.
Oh, that's, yeah, we've had a great system with that.
That's good.
State.
Yeah.
So I see that and that, and I know we want to talk about local currency, but let's not. Okay, go ahead.
I'm thinking our food bank. Our church does the food bank for our county. And we have begun to, as much as possible, using the community garden and local farmer fresh vegetables. But another key that I want to see built into that, and hand in hand with that, is cooking classes.
Yes.
For the
yeah.
population that uses the food bank.
Yeah.
Because really,
yeah.
they have been eating McDonald's, French fries, and hamburgers for so long. They don't know how to cook.
I'm doing my first cooking class with the Open Door Food Show in a couple weeks. So, there's this group called Freedom 90 in Canada, and Andy Wallace said it was made up of the old church ladies, but they have a song on 50 ways to close my food shelf. And so it's a fun thing. You can check that out. Freedom 90 in Canada, and they have a really beautiful song, and that's what they're, and one of the big things they're working on is basic income. They're supporting a basic income. Because they're like, we want, and the Freedom 90 is, we want to retire from supporting the food shelf system. We want to retire from that. So how do we change the system so food shelves aren't needed? Obviously, they're needed right now.
Real quick,
go ahead.
Real quickly, just to give you ideas possibly, my co-op, she sources some of her foods from small farmers, and she also supports local producers. Like she, somebody makes coconut oil, so it's a little business. Another person makes bone broth soups, and another person makes handmade soaps. So she's supporting through her co-op. There's 300 families in that co-op, and it's totally family-run. They have their kids helping and everything with these 300 families. And then the other, our other
state is that in again?
Illinois.
Illinois. Okay.
And our other group supports. There was an offshoot group that had cooking classes in kitchens. We have presentations, so the members will give presentations on whatever they're interested in, and we'll have cooking classes, gardening classes, and all that kind of thing. So. Ideas.
Hi. I just want to say one last thing, piggybacking off of what you said about the money system in this country and the fact we don't have the income that we should have to get our basic needs met. That I'm a member of one of the organizations that's a sponsor called the American Monetary Institute, and some of you may have come to our. But what we want people to understand that is something that's not taught in our schools ever, not including the college, and it's connected to those people in 1952 that said in Washington we have to bring in free trade because. They knew they could undercut our family farms and bring in the corporate farms using the money system. Yes, they knew that. That was a long-range plan because they used the money system to do that. And I just want people to know, and I'll give you a website, but our monetary system today, all of our money, whether you have it, you know, in this bank or that bank, all that money that's ours that we have to live on is not created by our government.
No. Yeah.
It comes from those private commercial banks because they have the legal right to make it when they make loans. All of our money has interest going to those commercial banks. And that system is not taught because they don't want us to know it. And that's how they control us with it. They control it.
Okay, somebody said I'm going to go to her question, and then I. Do you mind if I say one thing? Because I might forget it otherwise. So this came off kind of spontaneously for me once, and I love it. I want to be as wealthy as my dog. I want to be as wealthy as my dog, right? And I know I want to get to Leanne about that, so we'll get to you first. But I want to be as wealthy as my dog. My dog has trust. My dog knows his food's coming. You wave a dollar bill in front of my dog, he doesn't care. You get a big bone, he likes the things that come from it. For whatever reason, with the mentally ill society we have, there are people that are like looking at money like my dog looks like a bone, and they will never stop. I get it. I want to have compassion to them. I sometimes do that with food myself. Occasionally with alcohol, not too often. but to just try to, you know, psychically make these shifts. And how we do that. So what did you want to say?
Well, I want to ask the people who are knowledgeable about the family.
Did you write that website down? The chart, okay.
What I'm wondering is the reason that they don't make, some of them don't make a lot of money, because a lot of people, I know they have farms, they work full-time jobs to do the farm.
Yes,
also,
right.
That's how they do it. But I've noticed that big, successful farmers that, you know, some of the really big ones, besides getting subsidies, that you have a lot of them that they're using very low-paid labor and bringing immigrants in, and they're not paying a good wage. And I know they tell us, well, you know, your food would be so expensive, and I feel like
liar, pants on fire.
You might not own, you know, that many acres. No, and so I'm wondering if that's part of the difference, is that it's just people who don't take advantage of others
It is money, but it's also a global money system, and so someone had this figure, I don't know where it came from, like $13 trillion. There's a huge problem globally with land grabs, people
that's
with
right.
money who are upset. They're not like my dog, they're like the zombie.
And you can't feed the zombie. He will never have enough money.
That's right.
You know,
that's
right. He just wants more and more and more ego and more patterns. And so if we can, I think the way to defeat the zombie is the same way they actually did it in the Walking Dead movie. Again, I haven't watched television.
Yeah, I don't watch it.
I'm like, oh my God, this is so not me, but I'm obsessed with it. But then I thought about it. It's the patterns. People form trusting groups. You knew the people you could trust, and you trusted them, and they suffered, and you suffered with them. And I will say we need to suffer with the animals in the
farm. How did that stop the zombies?
That just got a really good comment from somebody viewing. He says, they could subsidize family farms by ending property taxes on family farmers.
That's a great way. I love that idea.
Another one says, shoot them in the head.
Would you say that? So, Leanne, do you want to talk a little bit about...
Just kind of like in regards to money, there is kind of now new ways to kind of create money. It's on the blockchain, you know, the cryptocurrency. And I just, last night on Facebook, there was kind of like an article coming across my feed is that one of the candidates, the writing candidates for mayor of Detroit, was kind of suggesting to give people a basic income in dollar money, but also then to start a new local currency based on the blockchain, a cryptocurrency. Mm. So, I mean, it's kind of like we can, you know, with Bitcoin, I mean, that's kind of up to the speculators and whatever, but we can actually, what I learned yesterday in the beautiful workshop by Sarah Mansky on the blockchain is that we can take over that technology and kind of make local currency and through, you know, the blockchain. So and kind of start taking over the monetary system, at least locally.
Right, and like chocolate was food. I mean, chocolate was food. Chocolate was considered a currency once upon a time. And so what she said is right now, in the blockchain stuff, it's gonna make my eyes glaze over. You know, it's like, what does that mean? But what she was saying is, this is like the beginning, just like the internet, and this is gonna take over, and it will probably go towards the zombies or the living system. But it's a tool, and so like someone has created fearcoin.com, or Swarm, which is, I looked at their website, and I love the Swarm.
I'm also on the advisory board on a cryptocurrency that is issued as basic income, Grandcoin. So I mean, if you just sign up and then you kind of get the currency. So I mean, we have currency and we can just start using it. So I mean, there's other ways. I mean, the taxes are not clear. You know, you're supposed to, but I mean, we can start taking over the monetary systems without going through the federal government.
Well, it's community currencies have been with us a long time, so it would be useful as a tool to bridge the gap, but it's not getting at the root of the system, and that's the problem, is trying to get the root, and that's a long term. So the community currency, developing those, can be useful as a stopgap method toward.
But also, if you issue it as a basic income, you know, so then you can have.
What you want to do is circulate in the local economy and try to make that local economy because farm communities are dying. I mean, I go on road trips, and that's what we do. We look at these farm communities, and they're really awful. They're so sad. I mean, it's tragic.
Yeah.
So that might be a stopgap method. But somebody was interested in the presentations that they hadn't seen from our group, American Monetary Institute. We had five of them, and they'll be up on YouTube at the AMI channel. So if anybody's interested, in about three weeks.
Excellent.
And I have a website, which teaches the basics of the monetary system called greensformonetaryreform.org.
Great. So here's my idea, because we actually went over, but I don't think it matters because the team's not 10. So I'm going to take your question, and then let's just do a little checkout, and then if we want, we can walk. Those who want to can walk to the community garden and eat tomatoes fresh from there. So,
but you're sure you want to do that?
Yes, I'm sure you can.
Thank you. I appreciate it. So in the movie Tomorrow, they show successful examples of dual currencies working in some localities around the world. And I want to pass this around for everybody to look at, energy that's coming here. And also, as far as local food, regenerative food, and affordable food, the Main Street Project in Northfield, Minnesota, where the college is located in southern Minnesota, has kind of a model for micro farming. and that's going to be looked at as the permaculture convergence of the organic compound in southern Minnesota. You Google organic compound. And one model for affordable food is the Hmong community, the Asian community in the Twin Cities, who have their own farms. One of them is down by Hastings. And so they grow their own food, and they feed their own people, and they sell some of it. And so you don't, they have taken the full step beyond just going to a farmer or working with a farmer, to the members of their communities being members, and some of them active members of a farm or two or three in the suburbs. And so you can use them as a model to make that step beyond just the CSA, share membership, and to actually being an active participant on a farm or being a member of a farm in the suburbs, which is more regenerative and affordable.
So, awesome. Well, I'll check. I thought it was a great discussion. And the thing that I'm second was, as a farmer that's only making $3,000 a year.
Yeah. That's right. Mm-hmm.
And
that's
he already
right.
owns his farm and the equipment.
Yeah.
And he's built it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's hardly sustainable.
Horrendous. No, it isn't.
No.
The cost of offering is.
He's got to get a good price for his crop.
Yeah, so we can just go around and then I'll. So, anything you want to say, just kind of take a few seconds and say it.
I want to make a couple of suggestions about water. I shop in the food, and we have a huge Somali community here. And of course, we still have a huge Southeast Asian immigrant. And immigrants come out with racks of water bottles. Huge, I mean, they fill their shopping carts with water bottles. So I walked to them and I said, why are you buying all this water? Well, my wife likes to drink water. I said, good, that's healthy. But you're paying more for your water than you are for your gasoline. And a lot of the water comes out of taps. We have very clean water in St. Paul. I live in St. Paul. And there are companies that fill the bottles from the tap with tap water.
Yeah.
And then mark up the price and sell it to you, and all you're doing is making them rich, and forget about wasting the bottle or making the bottle, because he doesn't really know about that or care about that.
What
his water wants, his wife wants water, and she knows that it's safe in bottles because it didn't used to be back home.
So I
stop them and I tell them. There are lots of immigrants all around the country that are really subsidizing this outrageous water thing. The other thing is theaters will sell bottled water for a buck. They make some money off of it, and people get water. And I am lobbying, and I've had a little success, to go with jugs of water and sell compostable cups. They can make just as much money selling the compostable cup, but we're not dealing with the water bottles. And then I say, you put up a sign and tell people what wonderful people you are. And generally, people who go to theater are white middle class people who think that's really groovy.
Yeah.
So they get a little public stuff. The other thing, if anybody's interested, from the Twin Cities, the BDS community, this is off topic, sort of. The BDS community is having a conference October 21st, and I have flyers about the BDS boycott, divest, and sanctions against Israel until they stop killing Palestinians. And we're going to be talking about parallel liberation struggles with Palestinians, Native Americans, and Black Americans, ethnic cleansing, land theft, oppression of populations. Of course, slavery is a really good way to control a population. We haven't exceeded that one.
Can I
do a follow-on to your water? So I live in East Phillips, which has a high Somali and high refugee migrant population. And what the neighborhood group voted on in a public meeting with about 150 people there was to spend a lot of money and hire the health department to take testing of children for lead and taking samples of water and then bringing back those results to the neighborhood group anonymously and to the individuals' families.
and that as a way to undercut, instead of saying that you should drink your safe tap water, which might be safe at the street level, but is it in your tap?
Right.
So that
it's
they know,
the
and they only do the kitchen sink. They're not, you know, they're not going way far out of it, and it's really expensive. And a health department is sort of overwhelmed, so don't introduce your neighborhood until next year when they finish ours.
Really? Any mini levels?
They haven't brought those back. Anything that they're finding, they would go to the families. They're not going to go
we're finding
and composite until they actually have
them. Wow.
We're finding some in St. Paul's elevated levels. We have free testing at community fairs for blood.
But this is house by house on this block. And it's only grade school children. The younger, the more they...
I work for Environmental Protection with the state. And I was with air, but I was in an office with a guy with water. And one morning he was running water, and I asked him why. He wasn't doing anything with it. He was just running the water. And he said, because I'm running all the water out of the line between the main line out in the street and here, because he said, if it's a lead pipe, then it's the water's full of lead, and I want the water from the main line out in the street.
He's right.
And also, if you want information, you can go to your divisions of water and get water sampling testing from Division of Water. Just know that they have run that from the main line before they tested it.
Oh, shit. What good is that?
Well, that the Phillips project and testing from
well,
the cat that's really...
I got another little... So I work with a station that's owned by a person who only owns one radio station, and so we've kind of built a little ecosystem of businesses. So these are businesses that you can support if you're locally, and also some of them you can even do nationally.
Oh, yeah.
So if you want to see these. You know, so... so that's the idea of how we find our friends.
Oh, great.
And how we find that community. So,
is any of your information going to be online or otherwise available?
No, none of it's online, but I do have extra copies. So if you didn't get any, I know I've got extra copies here, kind of scattered. But, and then I could slice this peach, I suppose. For anyone who wants to.
We better get going.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got one.
Okay. This is great.
It is.
Learned a lot from this.
That city you want.
If people are local, my local tap water is so awful. Now, the Brita filter, the pure filter does not...